Hey everybody, Paul Boyer here for the Madman Machine Show 173 for Wednesday, January 13th. Welcome, welcome, welcome. On this show, I want to talk about some of the analysis I've been doing on lazy portfolios and the inclusion of gold therein. I've got a pretty cool tool for you. And I've got this story out of Venezuela. With oil prices off their highs, his country in a recession, and prices soaring, President Hugo Chavez devalued the bolivar and vowed to fight speculation and price increases that could result from the devaluation. At Caracas's middle-class Sambil shopping mall, lines at cashiers reached 50 deep. Carmen Blanco, a 28-year-old accountant, waited to buy a 42-inch flat-screen television she doesn't need because she already has one at home. "It doesn't make any sense to keep my savings," Ms. Blanco said Saturday. "I'd love to see how things work in a normal country." Murray Rothbard described this in The Mystery of Banking. He said, "Chaos ensues, for now the psychology of the public is not merely inflationary, but hyperinflationary. And phase three's runaway psychology is as follows. The value of money is disappearing even as I sit here and contemplate it. I must get rid of money right away and buy anything. It matters not what, so long as it isn't money." A frantic rush ensues to get rid of money at all costs and buy anything else. And now a song from Randy Stonehill's album, The Sky Is Falling, Venezuela.
My best friend's in Venezuela, and he sent me a letter and a photograph. When I miss him so, you know, his letters always make me laugh. Well, he's down there in the southern sun, where the ocean waves roll blue. Walk.
So Venezuela joins North Korea in devaluing their currency. Let's see, in North Korea, I think it was 10 to 1. If you had 10 units of their currency, then after the devaluation, you ended up with having only one unit of their currency. So your wealth dropped by a factor of 10, basically. In Venezuela, it wasn't quite as dramatic. On Friday, according to the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Chavez weakened the bolivar to 4.3 per dollar from 2.15 per dollar. So basically, before, you could buy $1 worth of stuff for 2.15 bolivars. Now, to buy a dollar's worth of stuff, it'll take you 4.3 bolivars. That's instant inflation. But in order to protect his reputation, they decided the exchange rate for food would be different. Only 2.6 bolivars per dollar for imports of food, medicine, and other essential goods. The Wall Street Journal says that those rates even compete with a black market rate where the Bolivar had plunged, forcing the official devaluation. On Friday, the black market rate stood at about 6.25 per dollar. It's nice to live in the country with the world's reserve currency, isn't it? So the Randy Stonehill album has pretty good tunes on it from 1980, produced by legendary 70s Jesus musician Larry Norman. The album features the songs One True Love, Through the Glass Darkly, Teen King, The Great American Cure, Venezuela, Counterfeit King, Jamie's Got the Blues, Bad Fruit Emily, and Trouble Coming. All in all, a good album. With the turning of the calendar page, it's time to look at the performance year to year of Lazy Portfolios. And I've started doing a little bit of that out at the website. I did a little bit on the show last week. And wanted to look in particular at one aspect of Lazy Portfolios, and that is, what is the impact of the addition of gold into a portfolio? You know, out at madmanmachine.com/portfolios, I've got a list of some of the lazy portfolios that the professionals have already constructed. Names like John Bogle, Scott Burns, the guys out of Fund Advice, Andrew Tobias, William Bernstein, Bill Schulthes with his coffee house portfolio, Frank Armstrong, David Swinson, IFA. And none of those portfolios, none of those lazy portfolios contains gold. All they contain are stocks, bonds, and maybe some cash. None of them contain gold except for one, the Harry Brown Permanent Portfolio, and in large quantities compared to everyone else. Harry Brown recommends 25% of your portfolio go into physical gold as best as you can. I wonder if he were alive today if he would recommend the GLD, exchange-traded fund. It's an easy way, I guess, to get some gold, but maybe not the very best way. Harry Brown, if you don't know, was the Libertarian candidate for president in 1996 and again in 2000. He had a radio program. He wrote several books, and he passed away from us about 4 years ago, 2006 to be exact. Well, he recommended a very simple portfolio of 1/4 in the total stock market, 1/4 in a long-term bond index fund, 1/4 in money markets, just cash, and the last 1/4 in gold. So I wanted to look and see, does this make sense, putting money in gold? And does it make sense over varying time spans and varying quantities and things? And so to do that, I went out to bogleheads.org and got a hold of Simba's spreadsheet. Simba, who keeps his identity anonymous as far as I can tell, but uses Simba from The Lion King as his avatar on the website. He created a spreadsheet which allows us to backtest portfolios going all the way back to 1972. These are Vanguard mutual funds that have been around since 1972, with some exceptions. For example, the TIPS mutual fund wasn't around then, but he has a simulated TIPS return that goes all the way back, TIPS being a Treasury inflation-protected securities. Those are the bond funds that the government will help you out if inflation happens, basically. But so we use Simba's spreadsheet. Now, Simba hasn't updated the spreadsheet yet for 2009 data. That's something I undertook on my own. I went out to Vanguard.com and put in all the returns for all the funds for 2009. Then I was able to go in and look at some lazy portfolios and see what happened when we add gold. So I wanted to take one in particular. I picked as the point of analysis the IFA Index Portfolio 25. It's a lower risk portfolio because it's 65% in bonds. That means 35% in equities. Much lower risk, of course, than the Index Portfolio 100. But I didn't actually use, of course, the Index Funds Advisors recommended mutual funds, which were from Dimensional Fund Advisors. I used the ones that are in Simba's spreadsheet. I used Vanguard funds. And actually, out at IFA, they have a comparison between IFA's Portfolio 25 and a simulated Vanguard Index Portfolio 25. And just to let you know what the composition would be there, you'd have 7% in Vanguard S&P 500, 7% in their large cap value, 3.5% in small cap, 3.5% in small cap value, 3.5% in REITs, the real estate trust, 7% in developed markets, that's international markets, 3.5% then in emerging markets, and that rounds out the equities component of the Vanguard 25 portfolio, number 25. And then the last 65% is in Vanguard short-term bond, according to IFA. So if we had invested in that portfolio for the last one decade, our compound annual growth rate, which is the annualized rate of return on that portfolio, works out to be about 5.6% annualized growth rate with a standard deviation or risk of 7.1%. Now, if you do a little math, if you use a Sharpe's ratio on this, basically you're dividing one by the other and subtracting out the risk-free rate of return, this works out to a Sharpe ratio of 0.41. A higher ratio is better because you're dividing the reward by the risk. You want the reward to be big. You want the risk to be low. If you plotted it on a graph, you want to be top left. High return and low risk. So, instead of investing in that portfolio, what if we put just 75% of our investment in this Vanguard 25 portfolio, and then the remaining 25% in gold over that time period? Well, running the numbers in Simba's spreadsheet, I come up with a compound annual growth rate of not 5.6%, but 7.5%, and with a risk not 7.1%, but 6.9%, resulting in a Sharpe ratio of 0.70. All right? And we would call this one Vanguard 25 with gold. And I've got an article out at madmanmachine.com with graphs and more description about this. Now, as a reference, I also show the Harry Brown permanent portfolio, which is a lot simpler, you know, one quarter in each, on the chart. And as it turns out, it actually had a better Sharpe ratio than even the Vanguard 25 with gold. So, but you say, well, 1999 through 2009 is not a long enough time span. So I did another analysis. I looked at the fund advice portfolio from Merriman out at fundadvice.com, those guys that do the Sound Investing Show. By the way, I guess Tom Koch and Don McDonald have left the Sound Investing Show after all these years. Now it's just Merriman. But anyway, so I took a longer term look at gold in a portfolio, and you can read more about this on the website. Bottom line is, for just the fund advice portfolio, over the entire time frame of 1972 through 2009, which I think works out to 38 years, that portfolio had a pretty good compound annual growth rate of 10.95%, with a risk of 11.6%, resulting in a Sharpe ratio of 0.51. Now, if we did the same thing, we put 75% of our investment in the fund advice portfolio and the remaining 25% in gold from 1972, we resulted in a little bit higher compound annual growth rate. Instead of 10.95, it was 11.09. A little bit lower risk, 10.08 instead of 11.6, and resulting, therefore, in a higher Sharpe ratio, 0.58. Well, I saw a quote recently that, why would you invest in gold? It says, when we look at the most recent 35-year period of gold, gold delivered a return of 5.34%, with a risk itself resulting in 17.6%. Gold is tremendously risky for not very much return over 35 years. See, you could have purchased a treasury bill that would have netted about the same return with a risk of just 0.89%. So you would have taken over 17 times the risk for a lesser return. Well, I think what that statement fails to realize is that when you combine assets in a portfolio, it's not the actual individual performance of the assets that really matters. It's how they work together. One zigs up and the other zags down over the entire time span. And I think what's important is gold and stocks are not completely correlated with each other, the prices on them. According to Harry Brown, stocks do well in prosperity. Gold does well in inflation. And they don't do well in the opposite times from each other. And it is apparently true. I did a study using Simba's spreadsheet some months ago, looking at correlation between all the asset classes and the CPI. And the number one on top was gold. It was the most correlated with inflation. And therefore, if you expect inflation, which I guess the folks down in Venezuela should have, then gold would have been a place to be. But according to Harry Brown, it doesn't matter what you expect to happen because no one can predict the future. Just invest in all possibilities and you will come out ahead in the long term. Well, there is one other neat little thing that I discovered using Simba's spreadsheet. And that was, you know, you can vary the amounts of percentages that you put in these different funds. They all have to equal 100%, of course. So you could put 50% in a stock fund and 50% in a bond fund. Or you could put 25% in stocks, 25% in something else like REITs, 25% in emerging markets, 25% in money market, and see what the result is. And so you keep playing with these numbers. Oh, what's the best one? What if I add a little bit of this and what if I add a little bit of that? What if I put a little bit of gold in here and I'll put a little bit of bonds in here? And over this long time span, which one did the best? And so this is kind of driving me crazy. Going in and, you know, subtracting a little bit here and adding a little bit there and then comparing to see which one did better. And I thought, man, it would be great if I could write a computer program to automatically go in and change these values and then give me the answer to the one that produced the best results over the given time span. And I thought about it and I thought, man, I don't know if I could write that. And then it hit me. Somewhere way back in the back of my mind, the phrase Excel Solver came up. And I've never used Excel Solver before. So I did what any good computer programmer would do, and I Googled Excel Solver. And sure enough, there came back an example of how you use this add-in to Excel to vary values in various cells according to some criteria that you set and look for a min or max of a certain result in another cell. And so what I looked for then, I used this Excel Solver to find the maximum value of the Sharpe ratio in the entire portfolios. And what you can do then is just say, for this entire range of cells, you know, the cells that have the percentages of the mutual funds that I would invest in, the percentages of each mutual fund, vary those between 0 and 1, being percentages, 0% or 100%. And don't let this bottom cell, which is the total, be anything other than 1. You know, we want the whole total of all the mutual funds that we invest in to be 100%. And then give me the answer. Well, you hit the go button, and it churns away for a little while. You know, you can see it incrementally counting at the bottom of the screen. And then, boom, up comes the answer. And therefore, it gives you an optimal portfolio for the given time span. And I did that, and here's what the results were for 1972 through 2009. And it's pretty simple. It said to put 79% in the Vanguard short-term bond, 14% in gold, 7% in the S&P 500 fund, and 1% in REITs. And the optimal portfolio, optimized by Sharpe ratio, resulted in a compound annual growth rate of 5.8% with a risk of just 2.6%. The Sharpe ratio in that was 1.12. And if you look on the graph of that with the Vanguard 25 portfolio, it is way to the left, but not as high up to the top. It's just the fact that it's so much farther to the left that that's why the Sharpe ratio gets down. Well, what about if we tried to make this portfolio with a little bit greater return, even though the Sharpe ratio wouldn't be as great? How could we tweak it just a little bit to get that higher return? Well, in this case, what I did is added in more gold. Instead of 79% short-term bond, I put it at 57. Instead of gold at just 14, I added it up to 35. And for that, what happens is the compound annual growth rate was about the same, as the Vanguard 25 portfolio with gold at 7.6% compound annual growth rate for the entire 10-year period, with a risk of just 7.7%, the Sharpe ratio of, therefore, almost 1, 9.99. And you can see that in the charts. Now, what does all this mean to us? What does it all mean going forward? You know, you can't invest your money in this portfolio that did well the last 10 years. You just can't do that because it just doesn't work out that way. There's no chance. There's a chance, but it's a small chance that portfolio will do the same in the next 10 years, will be the leading portfolio in the next 10 years. In fact, if you could probably do a sliding window of optimal portfolios, and I have done this, sliding 10-year windows of optimal portfolios, and you see this chart shifting with the little blobs on the chart moving around as you go through the 10 years. One comes up the winner of the 1 year and the one set of years, and it moves down in relation to some other portfolio the next set of 10 years. But one thing that does seem to be constant over these sliding windows of years as we change the various looks at the portfolios is it does seem that the addition of some gold in the portfolio really helps to raise the Sharpe ratio. It really seems to help increase the returns and decrease the risk. The amounts that come up are somewhere between, say, 4%, maybe up 5%, 6%, up to 10% in gold. I don't think there's anything that's optimal at up to 25%. But Harry Brown's Perimeter Portfolio, he designed it to be easy to implement, easy to remember, easy to implement. And it actually did pretty well. It held up pretty well in comparing it with against even optimal portfolios over various sliding windows of 10 years at a time and even the full 38-year period. Now, when we look at the 38-year period, I do caution, though, that the first couple of years, first 3 years, 72, 73, 74, had extremely high returns for gold since, the gold window was closed by Nixon in 1971 and so forth. So that's why I think some other analysts start with gold in 1975 after the big spike, the run-up in gold. And, you know, the results aren't as good, therefore, if you don't include the big spike, the big run-up. But why wouldn't you? Well, that's enough probably, if you're still listening, about lazy portfolios. Let's get on with pulling something out of the Madman Machine tool crib. So this is a tool that I found by reading bogleheads.org and reading about Simba's spreadsheet and lazy portfolios and the Harry Brown Permanent Portfolio and so forth. Matthew McClary often writes out at Bogleheads, and he pointed to his website, riskcog.com. And his executive summary about the site says, RiskCog is a portfolio construction methodology that aims to reduce the risk of a financial portfolio given a target compound rate of return. The risk-cog approach measures return based on compound or geometric returns and measures risk based on the time domain concepts such as max drawdown. A risk-cog optimal portfolio is the portfolio with the least risk chosen from the set of all portfolios that have acceptable compound returns. Standard deviation and other statistical quantities are not used in the risk-cog approach. Well, you can go out to risk-cog and you can click up on the tab at the top called products. That'll take you to another page. You can click then on the buy and hold portfolio diversifier, or the one with the alternate layout if you have a smaller screen. Actually, I got that backwards. The alternate layout is the one with the larger screen, I think. Either way, what you do is you can pick your favorite set of asset classes. The underlying data is Vanguard funds, the same funds that are in Simba's spreadsheet. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Simba's spreadsheet is running in the back on the server here to come up with the data. But it starts out with half total stock market and half five-year treasuries. And it shows you the compound annual return over the full period from 1972 through 2009. And you can play around with it. It's kind of an easy way of discovering the characteristics of some lazy portfolios. Now, one thing that's curious is they focus on compound return. And I think I would prefer, you know, they say they don't even worry about standard deviation. I think I would prefer actually if they did. Or if, even better, they focused on the Sharpe ratio and helped us find returns with minimum risk or maximum return. But I don't know. It's still worth a look. So that's our tool in the crib this week. The Reduce Risk Portfolio Optimizer from riskcog.com. And unlike other tools I've given you so far, this one is free. The iPad should be announced on January 27th. Well, at least that's my name for it. iTablet, iSlate, iBook. I prefer iPad. I like the way it rhymes with iPod. I like the way it's got the same sound as iPhone. Well, maybe not really. iSlate would be my second choice, just because it sounds cool. iBook would be my third choice. But I think it has too much of a focus on actually being a reader, because I want it to do a lot more things. iTablet sounds something like Dell Computer would call it. So after the Jesus phone, the iPhone, had people literally weeping in their seats upon its unveiling, well, the Apple tablet is set to be the next revolutionary gadget that we didn't realize that we couldn't live without. So here's my predictions or slash wish list for the thing that should be out in about 14 days, 2 weeks from today. I think it'll have the 10-inch screen that everybody's expecting. And it'll be basically a Honey, I Blew Up the iPhone looking thing. It'll have a home button at the bottom, and that's basically all you see physically. Aluminum back, buttons and holes along the edges, nice places to put your fingers to hold it in portrait or landscape orientation. It'll have a USB adapter to connect common things like cameras, flip phones, flip cameras or whatever, video cameras, and of course, iPhones. And yes, I want to be able to charge my iPhone from the battery of my iPad. Now, you won't need the USB adapter for the external keyboard, optional, and mouse, optional, because those will connect via Bluetooth. And while you're typing and mousing on your iPad, you'll need it to stand up somehow, won't you? So I'm wondering if this thing will have some sort of picture frame-like stand on its back that lets you sit it on a desk or table in either portrait or landscape orientation. Now, I keep harping on orientation. For me, this is the key to the iPad. Being able to read books and long PDFs on it in portrait mode. Portrait mode means that the long way goes up and down as opposed to side to side. Landscape would be side to side. Because I find reading books on my MacBook, which is landscape mode by default, to be too small a window into the text. And I don't know if there's many others like me, but the first thing I do on my new computers is to move all those dock things at the bottom or taskbar things from the bottom of the screen over to the left side. It gives me a little more reading room. And I even get rid of some of the menus and taskbars and status bars and things. But I think with the iPad in portrait mode, I will be in reading heaven, even on a smaller 10-inch screen. Well, the question is really, how will this iPad get on the internet? Of course, it'll have Wi-Fi. Everything has Wi-Fi. But will it be on the 3G or Edge networks, the cellular networks, as well? Will I have to buy more service from AT&T Wireless? Or will it tether through my iPhone? Will the iPad be a phone? My hope for the thing is that it will be a phone also, that it uses the same phone number as my iPhone, that I can talk on either one, and then I can switch between one and the other during a call, that I can surf on the net on my iPad while talking on my iPhone, and that it can let me make and receive calls with my Bluetooth headset if I want to, and that it can act perfectly well as a desktop speakerphone. Not too much to ask, right? Well, if the iPhone was the Jesus phone, then the iPad would be what? The God phone? But my guess of what will actually happen is much more limited. I think that for the first release, it'll have Wi-Fi, and it may have 3G and Edge data networking only. It won't be a phone. But you'll have to add some sort of appendage to your AT&T wireless phone plan to get remote internet on the thing. No calls. Talking is for iPhones, and that is the way we say it will be, says Apple. Maybe in a later release they can figure out if it makes sense to add a phone or not. Perhaps too many people will end up using it, the data plan, to make Skype calls. And they'll come around. Well, what about software? Is the iPad a small MacBook, or is it a big iPhone? Well, that's a tougher one to make the call on. I can make a good case for both. You want to be able to run something like iWork on the thing, right? Do spreadsheets and word processing and all that. But Apple wants you to buy 10 billion apps for the thing like they have on the iPhone. So it hits me in a flash. It runs macOS, but with an iPhone mode, so you can do both. But the iPhone OS is all about limiting what you can do. Apple wants tight control on what happens on the iPhone. Will Apple want to limit what you do on the iPad? If so, it'll be more like an iPhone, with some iWork apps available for download. Actually, in that case, they probably will throw in some iWork apps for free, but you gotta buy all the other cool stuff. So how will you use this thing if you've already got a MacBook and an iPhone like I do? Well, you'll have your iPhone in your pocket, your MacBook on your desk, and your iPad in your hands, on the couch, in a seat, or in bed. This is the media comes to me device. Read a book? Absolutely. The iPhone, you know, it already has a Kindle app from the Amazon store, so you can buy thousands of books for just $9.99 each and start reading. Well, knowing Apple, they'll probably start selling books too through the iTunes store. I don't want to miss a market, right? But I better be able to get PDFs onto this thing easily and freely, or it goes in the trash. Well, of course, you can watch movies, listen to music, surf the net, make blog posting, standard fare. It's the book reading that makes the iPad so special. And of course, it'll be the first successful touchscreen computer from Apple. The iPhone set the stage, but now we'll have pinch and zoom supersized. We'll be using our arms more to see those details from the satellite view. Oh, yeah, GPS. Big maps, finally. But would this thing be appropriate for the dashboard? Not unless it has a camera that can show you what's in front of the car. And speaking of cameras, it needs at least two. One on the back, like a normal iPhone, to taking videos of others, and one on the front, taking a video of you. Eh, maybe one on the side, just to be sly. But I'd really love it if the one on the front that takes the picture of you is actually under the center of the screen, not at the top edge, but invisible to us. You know, we can see the data, the text that we're reading on the screen, but the camera is fully able to see us nonetheless. See, that way on video calls, people will be looking at you instead of somewhere off into space. Finally, the dreaded question. How much will they want for this thing? Remember when the Jesus phone first came out, how much they charged for it? Well, the same deal's here. Way more than we want to pay. They will really put it to those early adopter guys. I expect that early price to be $899. With netbooks selling for $399? Yep, but it will drop a few months later to just $699, and everybody will be like, woo, now I can afford one at last. So prepare for the iPad invasion. Prepare for the weeping, shaking bodies to behold not the iTablet being brought down from the mountain, but the iPad being unveiled on Steve's stage. I can't wait. I'm very happy that you joined me here at the Madman Machine podcast. I hope you'll continue to subscribe through iTunes and download the show and tell some friends about it. This is Paul Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes iPad predictions to make a Mad Money Machine. You know, one thing I'd like for you to do is go to madmoneymachine.com, and at the left, at the right side there, you'll see a link to the Facebook fan page. If you're on Facebook, go ahead and click the link and become a fan of the Mad Money Machine show. We have 11 fans already. Isn't that wonderful? Well, and I've gotten some friend requests from listeners to my Facebook account. Excuse me. I don't think I'm going to befriend people on my Facebook account. I'm not really sure what it's all about. They're not really sure how to use Facebook properly with listeners. So I'm going to start with doing it at the fan page and see what happens from there. You can also stay alert to my Twitter tweets, twitter.com/madmoneymachine. You can email me, feedback@madmoneymachine.com. You can call me, 571-366-7121. I need to write that down somewhere. But have a great winter, and I'll see you next week.